We have some books for sale that I want to tell you about because they're all three hot off the press. But before I do, I found this in the pulpit just a second ago. Caught my attention. Now, you know, people who've in the past tried to criticize us have been so absurd as to say that we keep a loaded 45 pistol under the pulpit here. We don't carry a loaded 45 pistol, but we do carry a bumper sticker that says, "Boycott France." And anybody that accuses us of having a pistol under the pulpit, tell them to get the caliber straight. Okay, now, there are some great books. This is a book called Family Reformation, The Legacy of Sola Scriptura in Calvin's Geneva, and it's the first of its kind. I've been waiting for this book for years, so to speak. It goes through what Calvin believed about marriage and family, raising children, every aspect of family life that you could imagine. And a friend of mine, Scott Brown, wrote the introduction to it and various other small places in it, but it's basically Calvin, where he goes through all of Calvin's works and quotes him. This book is $7.50, and there's just three or four of those. If those run out, there's one right here. And then here's Don Crow's book, finally. Now, there are a lot of great books on creation, but this one fills a gap that needed to be filled. Because besides defending creation, there's no other book I know like this book by Don Crow. He writes on the history of the debate between evolutionists and creationists, particularly as it relates to Presbyterian Church. And then he talks about the future of evolution. So it is a very useful book, and it's $15. This is $7.50. This is $15, and there's several of those. And then finally, John Otis's book has come out on Masonry and Masonic Lodges. This is, I think, will prove to be the most thorough and best and most accurate exposé and refutation of Freemasonry that available today. And I guess this has cost about $15 as well. So if you want to get all of them or any of them, you can write a check, of course, to the church. $15, $15, $7.50. Now, when you came in, you should have gotten two pictures of the man we're going to talk about today. Anybody not get these pictures, raise your hand. And if you want one, here's one up here. So if Mr. Berg would come up here, raise your hand there, sweetie. And anybody else not get one? Up here, right up here. All righty, and then in the far back. Thank you, sir. Turn with me to the book of Joshua, chapter 1. The book of Joshua, chapter 1. Moses has died, and now Joshua is taking over the leadership of Israel and leading the invasion and conquest and occupation of Palestine. And in Joshua 1, we'll start reading with verse 5 and read through verse 9. No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it, for then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. I think that the generation that Moses led into the land of Palestine was the godliest generation of Jewish people in all of history. And there were three changeless factors in Joshua's life. A written book, that is his Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and then God told him to add to the Bible the book of Joshua. So that's a changeless factor. He lived by this book, didn't swerve to the right or to the left, knew that it was only as he obeyed the Lord that he would have any success in what God had called him to do. The second changeless factor was the power of God. He saw the power of God and the providence of God work in his life in ways that to this very day, when we read about them, we stand in awe at God's greatness. And the third changeless factor is the supernatural leader, one who identified himself to Joshua as the captain of the hosts of the Lord. Even though Joshua was a great general and a great military commander, he recognized that he was accountable to an even higher authority. And that was, even in those days, the Son of God, whom he identified as the captain of the Lord of hosts, was an appearance of Christ before his incarnation. So a written book, the power of God, and a supernatural leader were the three changeless factors in Joshua's life. Now, I refer to Joshua because tonight we're going to talk about a man who has been called the Joshua of the Huguenots, the Joshua of the French Revolution, Gaspard de Coligny. And if you've ever been to Amelia Island, you know there is a place in Amelia Island called Coligny Plaza. And you say, well, why'd they name a plaza after this Frenchman that lived in the 16th century? Because it was on that part of North America, in Charleston, Savannah, etc., where the French Huguenots fled to this country back in the 1600s. So we're going to talk about Admiral Coligny. He was born into nobility in Burgundy, France, in 1519. His mother was Louisa de Montmorency, the tutor of the young Marguerite of Navarre that we've already studied. Among the honors that Coligny received in his lifetime, in 1551 he was made governor of Paris, in 1555 he was made governor of Picardy, and he was also made the Admiral of France. And while he was admiral, was one of the two or three most powerful men in France, second only to the king, and sometimes stronger than he. And all this by the time he was 40 years of age. His biographer, and this is the only one I can find, you can get it on the internet if you want to copy it, print it, it's about 300 or 400 pages, by the name of Besant, says that Coligny was a man of indomitable patience, steadfastness, and clearness of brain. He brought together the Protestantism that was scattered loosely over the whole country of France, and which, had it not been for him, would have been stamped out as it was in Spain and Italy. Though he fought many losing battles, he never gave way, and when the reform cause seemed on the verge of victory, he was struck down by an act of treachery, the likes of which there is none other in history save Christ, nor will there ever be, let us hope, while the world lasts. He says, other great men adorned that age of struggle and upheaval. Coligny overshadowed them all. His courage never quailed, his hope never faltered, and the keynote of his character was steadfast hope. No single piece of slander to his discredit could ever have been invented by his own foes or whispered by his own friends, because had there been slanderous remarks of Coligny, no one would have believed them. His friends trusted him, and his enemies trusted him as well. He distinguished himself as a courageous soldier in several military campaigns against France and in Italy against France. At one point in 1543, he was seriously wounded in his neck. On another occasion, in a failed defense of St. Quentin, he was taken prisoner. And after paying a ransom of 50,000 crowns, he was released after 4 years of imprisonment. And as we shall see later, he was the great military leader in France's civil wars between the French Roman Catholic government and the French Calvinists, or the Huguenots. Besides being a courageous military leader, he was an innovative and effective military reformer, whose reforms have lasted to this very day in militaries all over the West. Now, we would assume that as long as there have been militaries, there's been things like this, but no, there haven't been. The French infantry, before Coligny, was largely comprised of Swiss mercenaries that Zwingli was always writing against. And they would fight, they were great fighters, and they would fight for any cause if paid enough. They also had no use for principle or for discipline. Coligny was the first general in modern history who realized the important value of a strictly disciplined military army instead of a disorderly one. Infractions against laws, orders, or morality were severely punished. If a soldier in his army and navy insulted or attacked a woman, he was to be executed. Some blasphemies were punished by 8 days in prison with only bread and water, and if the blasphemies continued, the punishment would be even more severe. So then, Coligny introduced military discipline, but he also supplemented that discipline with the creation of a military hospital and the formation of a surgical service. He had carts like ambulances that followed his armies everywhere they went, so that he was the inventor of the modern ambulance corps. He was instructed in biblical studies and biblical truths as a child. After an heroic but failed attempt, as we said, to defend San Quentin from the Spaniards, on August the 27th, 1557, he was imprisoned in a fortress in Flanders for 4 years. While there, he fell seriously ill and found ease and consolation in reading Christian books, especially the books written by John Calvin. During that imprisonment, he was converted to the Reformed or Huguenot faith. He expressed his faith in his memoirs, which he composed while he was a prisoner of war. And here's his words. "All the comfort which I have, is that which, it seems to me, all Christians ought to take, namely, that such mysteries do not take place without the permission and will of God, which is always good, holy, and reasonable, and who does nothing without just reasons, of which, however, I know not the causes, and of which also I have no great need to inquire, but rather to humble myself before him in conforming myself to his will." So he said, everything that happens to me, including this imprisonment, is the will of God, and many times we don't know what God's doing, and he says, I don't even care to ask, because I will submit. John Calvin wrote his first letter to Coligny, a letter of encouragement dated September the 4th, 1558, while Coligny was still in prison. And I want to read that letter to you. It is dated, as I said, from Geneva, September the 4th, 1558. Monsieur, I trust that having read the present letter, this is to Coligny, inasmuch as it will furnish you with a proof of the extent of the interest I take in your salvation, you will not feel offended that I have written to you. I would not have delayed so long in discharging this duty had I had as easy access to you as I have on this present occasion. I shall not make any longer excuses, being convinced that the reverence in which you hold my master, the Lord, will cause you to find good whatever you shall see proceeding from him and laid before you in his name. Neither shall I employ any long exhortations." Now he's going to say that several times, but he says, now I know I don't need to exhort you, but, and then he exhorts him. "Neither shall I employ any long exhortations to confirm you in patience, because I am of opinion, nay, I have heard, that our Heavenly Father has so fortified you by the power of the Spirit, that I have occasion rather to give him praise for his kindness than to urge you to greater efforts. And in fact, Here it is that true greatness of mind should make itself manifest. That is, in overcoming all our passions and emotions, in order not only to gain the victory over them, but to offer a true sacrifice of obedience to God. Now, it is not enough to show ourselves valiant and not to faint or lose heart in adversity unless we keep this in view, to submit ourselves entirely to the will of God and acquiesce in it peaceably. But since he has already bestowed on you such constancy, I have no occasion, as I have said, to exhort you to it. Only I pray you to let me call your attention to one thing more, which is that God, in sending you this affliction, has intended to set you apart, as it were, that you might listen to him more attentively. For you know but too well how difficult a thing it is, in the midst of worldly honors, riches, and power, to lend to God an attentive ear, because these things draw our attention too much in different directions, and as it were absorb us, unless he make use of such means as the present of bringing under his wings those whom he has chosen for his own. Not that dignities, high place, and temporal blessings are incompatible with the fear of God, seeing that even in proportion as he exalts men, he gives them an opportunity of drawing still closer to him and of feeling a stronger impulse to honor and serve him. But I believe you have experienced that those who stand highest in worldly rank are so occupied and, as it were, held captive by it, that it is with much ado they find leisure to set about in good earnest the principal study, which is that of doing homage to God, dedicating themselves fully to him, and aspiring after the heavenly life. Wherefore, sir, I entreat you, inasmuch as God has afforded you this opportunity of making progress in his school, as if he wished to whisper secretly in your ear, to give good heed so as to savor better than ever, to feel the real worth of his doctrine, how precious and desirable it ought to seem to us, and to devote your leisure to the reading of his holy word, that you may derive instruction therefrom and become more deeply rooted in faith, so as thereby to be fortified for the rest of your life to struggle against all temptations. You know what corruptions everywhere prevail. So much the more should the children of God be ever on their guard not to mingle in them, lest they share in their pollution. True it is that in our days everything will be tolerated, rather than the resolution to honor God in purity, so that you cannot render him faithful service without being forced to endure many murmurs and threats. But for that reason, the honor of God should claim from you so unique a privilege that everything else ought to be held vile in comparison. And his favor certainly deserves to merit the preference over that of all his creatures. We have one great advantage, that if we are weak, he has promised to supply of his power with what is lacking in us, as indeed our real arms are in everything to fly to him for refuge, entreating him to be our strength. For the rest, sir, though the glory of God and the things appertaining to his reign should always hold the first place in our esteem, trust likewise in the promise of our Lord Jesus Christ that the rest shall be added thereto. Don't doubt this in giving yourself up to the service of God, but that you should feel his blessing in everything, and that he will prove to you what care he takes of his children to bestow on them what is fitting even for this transitory life. Just as on the other hand, there is no true prosperity without his grace, and even when those who withdraw from him fancy they have gained everything, they feel in the end that their success has been converted into misfortune. But as these things are not easily admitted by human reason, you have need to exercise yourself by reading, as I fancy you do, and are resolved to continue doing. So you see, Calvin had a high esteem as well as a great concern for the future of Coligny. Coligny was exposed to the truth as a little boy. All of his mother's friends tended toward the Reformed faith, like Marguerite of Navarre. He was accustomed to hear criticisms of the Roman Catholic Church from his earliest days. When his mother died, she refused to see a priest. His brother was a Roman Catholic cardinal who had worked hard in reforming the church and who later recanted his Roman Catholicism. Actually, was never really a Roman Catholic. His other brother, Andelo, had already become reformed. All the people that he had learned to respect throughout all his life had gone over to the reform cause or were ready to do so. As a young man, he was, so to speak, more than half Huguenot already. It was almost inevitable in those days for a serious student of the Bible in France or Scotland, as Coligny was, who accepted the whole Bible as divinely authoritative, it was inevitable that those people would become Protestants, Calvinists, and Presbyterians. No other conclusion seemed possible in those days for Frenchmen or Scotsmen. His conversion was most certainly not for personal political advantage, because in being converted to the Reformed faith and to Christ, he lost everything. He lost the favor of the king. He lost all that he had acquired throughout his life. He understood that because of his position, he would have a powerful place as the head of the Huguenots. He eventually lost his influence in court, his future favor with the king, everything. For one reason, he was not satisfied with reforming the church from within. Now, I remember Paul, he wanted to leave the church. You remember Calvin would condemn, we preached on this, the Nicodemites in France. That is, these Christians and Calvinists who wanted to reform the church from within, like Marguerite of Navarre, never left the Roman Catholic Church, and thought that they could go through the various rites and rituals, which they didn't believe in, as long as their hearts believed the truth and was pure. And Coligny was not one of those people. Coligny loved books and various kinds of art. He filled his castle, Chatillon, C-H-A-T-I-L-L-O-N. At least that's where we pronounce it in West Virginia. He filled his castle, Chatillon, with everything that was beautiful and precious to cultured men who loved beautiful things. His biographer says that he lived in a home bathed in the love of wife and children, in the midst of paintings, gardens, statues, books, arms, armor, carriages, painted glass, and the like. And it was no time, because of his place and reputation, it was no time until all of Europe knew that Coligny had, to use the words of the 16th century, joined the religion, meaning the Reformed faith. He had a large retinue along with his family. He had a troop of gentlemen in his service. He had a small army of soldiers, servants, and miscellaneous other people. He made sure the Bible was read daily to all of his family and to all of his retinue. He had reformed preachers come and preach daily, and he educated his family in the manner of the strictest of the Huguenots. Early every morning, immediately after rising, he would pray with the whole household. Reformed ministers would instruct his household day by day in the history and evangelical doctrines of the Word of God. Public and private business occupied the admiral until dinner time, which was at noon. A psalm was read or sung by Coligny or some Reformed minister before and after dinner at his own castle or in an army camp. The same custom was observed at supper, after which prayers were said and another psalm sung. In his own house, it was the custom before supper for him to call everybody together and exhort them that someday they would have to stand before God and give account of themselves. And then he would say, "Do any of you have to make up with anybody else in the family?" And he would require them to reconcile with each other, who had quarreled with each other during the day. He had a global vision, just like Calvin. And I think it was Calvin that influenced him. You remember back when we talked about Calvin's view of evangelism, that he not only wrote on the subject and not only practiced it himself and not only created a school of evangelism and sent evangelists all over Europe, but he also sent evangelists all the way to Brazil. You remember the story? That was Coligny was behind that. In fact, the little settlement that they established there was called Fort Coligny. And what Coligny wanted to do, his vision was to have a free Huguenot culture where they would no longer be oppressed by Roman Catholicism, where they could evangelize the Indians there and build a civilization of the glory of God that was thoroughly reformed. There was a man that, you remember, that headed the venture named Ville Gagnon. That was his last name. And he said at first that he liked Calvin and was a Calvinist. Calvin sent a couple preachers to help these Huguenots and others start a colony there and evangelize the Indians. But in the midst of the process, Ville Gagnon turned back to Roman Catholicism. He may have faked it all along and started persecuting the Huguenots that were there, executing some, exiling some, and so that the whole thing was a failure, much to Calvin and Coligny's displeasure. Well, that was not the final time that Coligny tried to accomplish a world vision. St. Augustine, Florida. I saw before there was ever a city there, but in that area, Coligny was involved in trying to set up a Huguenot colony. You see, the greatest enemy of France was Spain. The greatest, one of the great enemies of the Huguenots was Roman Catholic Spain, but it was also an enemy of France because it wanted to control all the commerce and all the resources of the New World. And because Coligny was trusted by the vicious and deceitful and malicious and bloodthirsty and whatever else you want to say, Catherine de' Medici, she, for a while, she was the queen mother, and she was an Italian, and for a while she was the king's wife, but she, Coligny had such a powerful impact on her that for a while, before all the great Huguenots war, she gave, allowed the Huguenots to worship freely. She would attend some Reformed worship services, and Coligny talked her into helping to start a colony around St. Augustine, Florida. This was 1562 and 1564. They tried it a couple times. Neither time was successful. But just like the Brazil story would make a great movie, the St. Augustine story would make an even greater movie, and it would be rated R for violence. They sent Huguenots over there to establish a base, not only a Huguenot colony, but also to get in on the goodies that France had that Spain had a monopoly on, the gold and silver that allegedly was laying around everywhere, and all the various other resources, the Fountain of Youth, and all those various things, although Coligny didn't believe in the Fountain of Youth. But they wanted to get in on this. Plus, Coligny was trying to figure out how to end the fighting between the Huguenots and the government. If we could just get the Huguenots and the government to fight the same person or the same institution rather than each other, well, then the Huguenots would have a little peace. So he wanted to establish a base in Spaniard, Florida, and take the war to Florida, where Huguenots and soldiers of the government would have to defend this base against Spain and hopefully give the Huguenots a little peace. So also, the man that was appointed to lead the trip there, a man by the name of Ribault, R-I-B-A-U-T, found a new way to get to the New World from France, so that it only took just a few days rather than many more days, and he could get to Florida without being observed by the Spaniards. And so there was all kinds of reasons why Coligny wanted to start a Huguenot colony in Florida. It didn't work. A lot of these people were nobles, and as a result, the only food they had was what the fish they could catch and the food the Indians would bring to them. But then when wintertime came, the Indians had to eat their own food, and the Frenchmen were all starving because the nobles wouldn't work somebody else's job rather than nobles. They didn't even think to plant any seeds. And so they suffered pretty severely, and a remnant of them decided that they were going to go back to England. They'd given up. So they have the end. They don't have any nails. They don't have anything. So they get this natural glue and some rope made out of vines, etc., and the Indians help them build this boat, big for Indians. And they get on this boat expecting it to take shorter time than they thought. So they took enough food for the shorter trip. And they get out in the Atlantic, and all of a sudden there's a still with no wind for about 3 weeks. And their sails were their bed linen, etc. And so when they finally came, washed up on shore, as it were, when they finally got into the English Channel, they were emaciated, and the only food that they had in the whole trip was the person that drew the short straw. And so they survived. So Coligny tried it again. And this time they met with the Spanish in full force under the leadership of a murderous Spaniard by the name of Menendez. And he got all these people, all these Frenchmen, lined them up, said, "How many of you are Roman Catholics?" So the ones that were Roman Catholics raised their hand. He said, "Stand over here." And then he drew a line. And he said, "How many of you are Calvinists? Come and stand on this line." And when they came to the line, he would slit their throats. He would kill them. And then his soldiers just went into a blood frenzy and started stabbing all of these Calvinists, even many of them who had been dead for several minutes. And that ended the Huguenot colony, except there was always a French presence there. But the French wasn't going to let the Spanish get off that easy. And so later, there was another Frenchman that came with his troops and wiped out, justly and in revenge, wiped out the Spaniards who had butchered the Huguenots several months before. Philip II, the great devoted Roman Catholic, demanded that this man be sent to Spain and tried and be executed. And the King of England was so France, the powers that be at France were so intimidated they were about to do it were it not for Coligny's influence. And it was Coligny that talked the powers that be into not sending this man back to Spain. And as long as Coligny was alive, he was well protected. Now, I want to talk about Coligny's role as the Joshua of the Huguenots and the civil wars that they fought in those days. The most unhappy period of Coligny's life was his last 12 years, during which there were civil wars in France between the Roman Catholic government and the French Calvinists and the French Protestants trying to defend themselves. And it was particularly sad for him because, remember now, he was a powerful nobleman. And as a nobleman from his youth, he was trained to give unflinching loyalty to the king and to the king's royal court, which had always been characteristic of the great French houses. Rebellion against the king was unthinkable and could only be justified by the greatest of reasons. And also because in these wars, France would be torn apart, and Coligny loved France. Many beautiful provinces would be destroyed, and the soil of France, said one, would be covered with the blood of thousands of Frenchmen. He would see the enemies of Christ and of Christianity and the Reformed faith take advantage of every situation to carry out their evil plots. He would often plead toleration and urge it upon the civil magistrate and upon the church, but he was always treacherously disregarded. And so those last years of his life were sad years. His biographer says, "Nor was it a small thing for him, the man of culture and artistic tastes, the simple home-loving man who desired nothing more than to enjoy in peace the companionship of wife and children, that he would live to see his castle sacked of all its treasures, and his heart would be crushed by seeing his wife sink sadly into a premature death with two of his children, one brother poisoned and the other killed by hard work and fatigue. Coligny did everything he could to avoid war. He was tired of the government killing all these Calvinists, but he knew what war would mean, soldier that he was. The first civil war, but he couldn't avoid it. The first civil war began in 1562 with the massacre of Vassy, V-A-S-S-Y. That was a town of 3,000 people, 900 of whom were Protestants. They were given the freedom to worship, they thought. And on a Sunday morning, they had gathered in a big barn outside of town to worship. The Duke of Guise, G-U-I-S-E, ordered that soldiers enter the barn and begin firing on the congregation, all of whom were unarmed. 64 men, women, and children were killed, 200 wounded, and the First Civil War had begun. The Protestants took up arms, and the Huguenots looked to Coligny to declare war. And he informed Catherine de' Medici that he was taking their side and would effectively defend them. Massacres of the Protestants by the government increased, and these cruelties provoked retaliation by the Huguenots. The French government ordered all Roman Catholics in France to take up arms against the Huguenots and start killing them. 50,000 French Calvinists were murdered. In the First Civil War, the Huguenots were forced to surrender in a humiliating and disastrous peace. Coligny was against the surrender and the signing of the peace. The peace that ended the First Civil War made it comparatively quiet for the Huguenots for a few years. During these years, Coligny worked to protect France from Spain by humiliating Spain and advancing the reform cause through the Netherlands, which had revolted against Spain. Admiral Coligny raised 6,000 Swiss troops, big mistake, to defend France, contrary to the advice of Jean d'Albret and John Calvin. The French court still hated Coligny and the Huguenots, and it turned the Swiss mercenaries against them and for the government. The chiefs of the Huguenots met and prepared for another war, with Coligny calling for patience. During the peace, the Huguenots had grown stronger, more numerous, better organized. Coligny had an intelligence network throughout France and was quickly becoming too strong for the government. The Huguenots now controlled 50 cities in France. The Huguenot armies, with the help of Germany, were successful all over the nation. Catherine de' Medici signed a peace without any guarantees, intending only to disperse the Huguenots. Just prior to the signing of the peace, Coligny's wife, Charlotte, and his son, Gaspard, died of the plague. After the signing of the peace, Coligny retired to his precious castle. But attempts were still made on his life. In fact, troops were sent out to arrest Coligny, but he found refuge in the city of La Rochelle, which was the capital of the French Reformation. Jean d'Albret also found refuge there. 20,000 men were rallied to defend the city. The French Roman Catholic government had an equal amount of soldiers in their armies. On March the 13th, 1569, the Battle of Jarnac, J-A-R-N-A-C, was fought, and the Protestants were defeated, and they lost one of their most important leaders, a man by the name of Condé, C-O-N-D-E, second in power only to Coligny. But because the state did not follow up the victory, the defeat was not that a significant loss for the Huguenots. Jean d'Albret rode, we'll be talking about her, rode among the troops to encourage them and lift their spirits. She gave the Reformed cause and the armies of the Reformed cause her lands, her jewels, all her treasures, her life, and her son, calling upon these Reformed troops to sacrifice everything for the cause of liberty for the Reformed faith. Coligny swore allegiance to the young Henry of Navarre, who was only 15 years old and proclaimed general of the Huguenot army. But because he was so young, the real power behind the throne was Coligny himself. He was the real leader. And it was during that last period of his military career that his real genius would be seen. Under his leadership, the Reformed army won more battles, and they were becoming more and more encouraged. A young 18-year-old Englishman fought under Coligny. His name, Walter Raleigh, as in Sir. Soon the Reformed army was worn down by the larger Roman Catholic army. Coligny and Jean d'Albret continued to encourage the troops to fight on till religious liberty was secured, but the troops were too weary and too outnumbered. But Coligny pushed on and came within 40 miles of Paris with his army. Catherine de' Medici gave way and on August 8, 1570, signed another treaty, giving the Huguenots again relief and liberty for the Reformed faith in all the cities that they controlled. That treaty gave them complete civil equality in the universities and the schools and the hospitals. It was the best peace treaty yet because Coligny wrote it. Coligny rejoiced, thinking that finally peace had been accomplished. All the while, the Pope, Philip of Spain, Catherine de' Medici, the Duke of Guise, and others were conspiring and neglecting no opportunity to break the treaty. By now, the admiral was alone. His wife, his brothers, his eldest son, his second-in-command, Condé, all of which had died. Only Jean d'Albret stood with him. And he longed to be able to trust the king, King Charles. And actually, from March to July 1571, Charles was disposed to talk to Coligny and to come to some understanding with him. In spring 1571, the admiral remarried. And so, in October, he retired again to his beloved castle, Chatillon, with his young wife and children. It was the last time he would ever see them. Yet Catherine was afraid of Coligny and the Huguenots and came to hate them, thinking that, in her words and ideas, fanaticism would prove stronger than patriotism, or the way we would say it, commitment to Christ is stronger than patriotism if the state that we love is tyrannical. Coligny came to recognize the treachery and deception of the Queen Mother. Soon, Catherine de' Medici finally realized that the only way they're going to have peace in France is to destroy Coligny and with him all the Huguenots. Meantime, a man named Maurevel, Maurevel, a hired assassin, the servant of the young Duke of Guise, was already making his bloody plans. On the morning of August the 22nd, the admiral was invited by the Duke of Anjou to settle a difference between two of his gentlemen. When the arbitration was complete, Coligny left the Louvre and retired to his hotel. On the way, he met King Charles of France, going to play tennis with the Duke of Guise, and accompanied them to the tennis court, where he left them and headed for home, followed by 10 or 12 gentlemen. On the way, a man handed Coligny a petition to read, He began reading it, walking slowly down the street. Suddenly, a shot was heard. The admiral dropped the paper. One finger of his hand was broken and his left arm badly wounded. Morrevel's shot had wounded him, but not killed him. Coligny was carried to his house. When the king heard that Coligny was wounded, he sent him his own physician and surgeon, a man named Ambrose Pare, P-A-R-E, who himself was not only a Huguenot, but was the first to practice the tying up of arteries and the modern treatment of wounds. Although the wound was not just slight, the danger in those days was being poisoned by the copper in the bullets. Coligny said to his worried friends, quote, "My friends, do not weep for me. I hold myself happy to have received these wounds for the cause of God." In the meanwhile, the Huguenots were mustering in the streets, loudly demanding justice, naming the real murderer not as Morrevel, but as the Duke of Guise, calling his name out. The country was exhausted. The blood of thousands had been spilled, and now more civil war was coming. Catherine believed that the only way to secure peace was to murder the leaders of her enemies. King Charles agreed. Time had come to rid France of Coligny once for all. The Duke of Guise arranged the details. The Roman Catholics were identified by a strip of white linen around their arm and a white cross on their hats. So you don't shoot at those people. The captains of the French armies and the Swiss mercenaries were waiting for the signal. It was about 1:30 on Sunday morning. Charles was anxious. Catherine maddened him, like she could do men, by calling him a coward. He sprang from his chair, crying, "Begin, begin!" And so the great city bell rang out at 2:00 in the morning. Then the streets were filled with armed men screaming out, "For God and for the king!" Their leader was Guise, who with 300 soldiers rushed to the admiral's hotel. Now let me read what takes place next from this old biography. They knocked at the outer gate, calling for admission in the king's name. It was opened. The man who stood to receive them was immediately murdered. The inner gate was forced open. The household was by this time roused. They barricaded the passages, a feeble defense, which served for the servants to reach the upper part of the house. Coligny was awake. His minister was praying with him. A valet rushed into the room. "Sir," he cried, "the house is broken open and there are no means of resistance." The admiral answered, "I have long been prepared to die. Save your lives if you can. You cannot save mine. I commend my soul to the mercy of God." Then for a brief space, he was left alone, save for his German interpreter who remained with him. They found him, that is, Guise's murderers, found him leaning against the wall, being weak and feeble after his wound, poisoned, and unable to stand. The first who entered was a man named Besme, a servant of the Duke's. "Are you the admiral?" he asked. "I am." Then looking in the face of the assassin, he said calmly, "Young man, you ought to consider my age and my infirmity, but you will not make my life shorter," meaning that he was already, because of his wound and the poison of the copper, at the point of death. Besme plunged his sword into Coligny's breast and gave him a second blow upon the head. The other soldiers who had crowded into the room dispatched him with their daggers. "Besme, Besme," cried the Duke of Guise from below. "Is it done?" "It is done, my lord." To satisfy his master, he threw his body out of the window into the courtyard. The Duke of Guise, wiping the blood from the dead man's face with his handkerchief, looked upon the well-known features of his enemy. "I know him," he cried joyfully. "It is he." He kicked the dead body with his foot and left it there, calling on his companions to go on with the good work in the name of the king. The rest of the story of St. Bartholomew's is well known among Calvinists. Beginning with the death of Coligny, the French government butchered some 36,000 Calvinists over a week period starting on Sunday, St. Bartholomew's Day. They would invite them to places and say, we have peace. And the government said, we will throw these big banquets for you. And the naive Huguenots would come, and then the soldiers would come out and kill them. And that's why France, this very day, is the most secular of all the secular nations in Europe, because all the Calvinists were killed, 36,000 of them on St. Bartholomew's Day. The Pope rewarded the messenger who brought him the joyful tidings about the death of Coligny and the Huguenots with 1,000 pieces of gold. And then the Pope offered up a solemn mass, thanking the Lord with all the College of Cardinals, and the Pope struck a medal to commemorate the glorious events of the murder of Coligny and the Huguenots on St. Bartholomew's Day. The Cardinal of Lorraine, one of the culprits in France, who was in Rome, celebrated the news, writing on the gates of the church an inscription in gold letters, thanking God for hearing his prayers, which were offered daily for 12 years. Philip II of Spain wrote to Catherine de' Medici that this was the best news she could possibly have sent him. The admiral was dead, and everywhere, those who were the enemies of Protestantism and the enemies of France rejoiced. When Admiral Gaspard de Coligny was martyred on August the 24th, 1572, he was almost 57 years old. His biographer said, there is no grander figure in the 16th century than that of the great admiral. There was no one like him, not one, even among the Elizabethan heroes, so true and loyal, so religious and so steadfast as the great admiral. He has become a proverb for fidelity, honesty, and courage. For 3 days after St. Bartholomew's massacre, the populace amused themselves with dragging the headless trunk of Coligny through the streets of Paris. Then they hanged it by the feet on a gibbet, where the king and all of the court rode to see their victim. During the night, a faithful servant stole the mutilated corpse and placed it in a lead coffin. It was eventually taken to Catillon for greater security, where it was bricked up in a recess in the wall. The place of Coligny's burial was forgotten by his unworthy descendants. In 1657, the last Coligny dies, and the family title and lands pass to another family of Luxembourgs. 100 years later, the Duke of Luxembourg was at dinner in his chateau, which was Coligny's castle, when he was told that certain workmen, while making repairs, had discovered in the wall a lead box, doubtlessly containing treasure. It was opened and found to contain the bones of the great admiral. The Duke of Luxembourg did not conceal his disappointment. He gave the coffin to the Marquis of Montesquieu, who built a fitting tomb. On one side of the slab was inscribed Voltaire's account of the night of St. Bartholomew's. Then came the French Revolution. Once more, the coffin was removed, this time to Paris for safety. The Duke of Luxembourg asked the Count of Montesquieu to give it back, and finally the coffin was taken back to Châtillon, where the bones of the great admiral lie, resting at last among the ruins of his own castle. Let me read to you. If you have Calvin's commentaries, go to the book of Ezekiel and look at the dedication essay to his commentary on Ezekiel. Calvin had just died, 1564. This is dated January the 18th, 1565. And it is a dedication to Coligny, written by Calvin's successor, Theodore Beza. And here's what he said. And in Beza's dedication, you can see how the reformers viewed Coligny. I had rather exhort you, most noble sire, with all diligence to do what you are already doing and have most successfully begun, not only to read, hear, and meditate upon these sacred things continually, and to use them really, but also that you apply yourself to defend and preserve the churches by all just means consistent with your dignity and fortitude of mind. Your mortal enemies and those of all pious men do not disguise the fact that you are especially aimed at by those who think that they themselves cannot exist if the religion is preserved. But I do not know you if these very dangers do not rather sharpen than relax your courage. You yourself have most strikingly felt and experienced God's care in defending his own. Your innocence and integrity sufficiently defend you against all accusations. You possess, if any of your rank does, that inward and invincible guard within the breast, which profane men call a wall of brass, I mean a good conscience, in reliance upon which, believe me, you will easily surpass all your adversaries. Let me take 5 minutes to tell you about one of Coligny's children. She was named Louisa, after her father's mother. Her father, Coligny, provided Louisa with a great education, and her mother taught her the Reformed faith long before Coligny had accepted it. She married one of her father's soldiers, a man named Charles de Teligny. Though young, he was wise and was one of the Huguenot leaders. They were married at Rochelle in 1571. When Coligny went to Paris to attend the wedding between Henry of Navarre and Margaret of France, Teligny went with him, although he had been warned about going to Paris in anonymous letters. On August the 24th, 1572, in the Bartholomew Day Massacre, Louisa lost both her father and her husband. Louisa managed to escape. She made her way to Châtillon to warn them. The family fled to several locations, but Louisa fled to Geneva. So at 19 years of age, she was an orphan, a widow, an exile, and in poverty because her father's property had been confiscated by the Roman Catholic state. She stayed in Geneva for a while and then sought refuge with other Huguenots in Heidelberg. The French government offered to return her property to her if she would simply renounce the Reformed faith. But she refused, like Moses, rather choosing poverty and all the riches of France. She married again. This time she married a famous Dutch Calvinist freedom fighter by the name of William the Silent, the Prince of Orange in Holland. He came to her in 1583, proposed marriage, and they were married in Antwerp, April the 12th, 1583, and made a home in Delft, D-E-L-F-T, Holland. Although she was French, the Dutch soon came to love her. One said of Louisa, now married to William the Silent, Prince of Orange, she was a small, well-formed woman with delicate features, exquisite complexion, and very beautiful dark eyes, which seemed in after years to be dim with unshed tears, with remarkable powers of mind and angelic sweetness of disposition. On February the 28th, 1584, she had a son whose name was Prince Frederick Henry, who would become famous as the Prince of Orange and leader of the Netherlands. The King of Spain wanted Louisa's husband dead, William the Silent, and had offered a reward for his life. A failed assassination attempt took place in 1582, but in 1584, an assassin shot 3 bullets into William's body when he was trying to help the man. The prince staggered and said, "Oh my God, have mercy on my soul and this poor people." He died July 10th, 1584. Louisa was grief-stricken. At 32, she had been widowed twice. And the assassination of William reminded her, of course, and brought all the pain back of the deaths of her first husband and of her father. Through her life, she'd seen a continuous series of tragedies that would cause others to sink into despair, but not her. She had resigned herself, like her father, entirely to the will of God. Thus, William was assassinated, and Louisa, once again a widow, after being married for only 1 year and 3 months, with a baby 4.5 months old. Again, she was left penniless for a while, until the Dutch gave her an annual allowance of $4,000. She also had to care for William's 6 daughters by a previous marriage, the oldest of whom was 8 years old. She faithfully fulfilled the task. After the signing of the Edict of Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S, ending the war against the Huguenots for a time, until the king, who claimed to be a Calvinist, went back to Rome, Louisa returned to France, but she didn't live very long thereafter. Her son, Frederick Henry, whom she left in Holland, became ruler of Holland. When the Catholics realized she was dying, they sent none other than the infamous Cardinal Richelieu to try to win her back to Rome. But he was no match for her on her deathbed. She stood firm for Christ and the Reformed faith, and Richelieu left defeated. She died rejoicing in Christ on October the 9th, 1620. Her body was laid by that of her husband in Delft. Through her son, Frederick Henry, she became the ancestress of King William of England, William of Orange, married to Mary, William and Mary. One said, there never was one of more noble soul or a true lover of justice than this princess. And thus the blood of Admiral Coligny mingled with the blood of the House of Orange to produce emperors of Germany, rulers of Netherlands, and through William and Mary, kings and queens of England. Let us pray. We do thank you for the life of Admiral Coligny. We pray that in the struggles that we have to face and in the upheaval of our day, that you would raise up men of his caliber. For Jesus' sake, amen.